Well, Wednesday is July 15th, which most of us have never paid a lot of attention to before, but this year it's tax day. And so it's been delayed. It's wonderful to come up on Sunday mornings and remind you of tax day that's coming, but that's the reality of the world in which we live. But I was reading a story that caught my attention this week about 50 years ago and tax day. Jack Swigert was the command module pilot on Apollo 13, the famous Apollo 13. He wasn't scheduled to be the command pilot. He was the backup pilot, but Kent Mattingly had been in contact with someone who had measles, and because they were concerned about putting him on that flight, not knowing whether he had it, and he'd spread it to the crew and all of those kind of things, at the last minute, Swigert was pushed into that position and Mattingly was removed, and he scrambled and got ready, and they blasted off into space into what was going to become known as the successful failure. As a matter of fact, he was the one that first radioed Houston to say, "Houston, we have a problem," which has become memorialized in a film, obviously. But 24 hours in, almost exactly 24 hours in, on April the 12th, 50 years ago, he suddenly had this horrible thought pass through his mind. And so he radioed Mission Control and asked, "How do I apply for an extension on my tax return?" And we're told that the other astronauts broke up in laughter, and Mission Control was breaking up in laughter that here he was in space asking for a mission extension. And he said, "It ain't funny. Things kind of happen real fast down there, and I need a tax extension." And NASA told him they'd look after it. And as it happened, there's a provision in the tax code that if you're out of country, then you can get a tax file. And for the sake of this, even though he was in an American spacecraft, they decreed that he was out of country and could have this extension, that extension. I laughed at that, because if you can think of any excuse that would be good with the IRS, it probably is, "I'm on my way to the moon." Well, they had more adventure, obviously, on the way, and it became an issue of whether they were ever going to get back from the moon, and you know the rest of that story. But excuses are interesting things, and some of us are very good at them, but Ben Franklin once said, "One thing you can be sure of, a person that's good at making excuses isn't good for much else." And if you've ever worked with somebody who was good at making excuses, you know the reality of how difficult that is to deal with it. As one of my friends used to say over and over, there's a difference between good sound reasons and reasons that sound good. But excuses are something that we're all tempted to, and Moses, faced by a call of God, which was absolutely awesome in the reality of it, found himself overwhelmed by what God was calling him to do, and excuse after excuse after excuse began to pour out of his mouth why he wasn't the person that God needed to do this. And it is an exchange that tells us a lot of things about the Lord, tells us some things about Moses, and to be honest, tells us some things about ourselves. So if you have your Bibles, we're at the burning bush. Moses, out of all expectation, encounters the living God, the first time in 400 years that anyone has had this kind of experience with the present God, out in the middle of nowhere on what we would later understand to be the mountain of God, Mount Sinai. But it wasn't thought of that way then. And we've had the first part where the Lord speaks to him, and we'll come back to it in just a minute. But we're going to look at chapter 4 and the last three of the five excuses. We've had two already as we walk through this passage. So let's read. We'll begin just reading the first 9 verses together. Then Moses answered, "But behold, they won't believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, 'The Lord didn't appear to you.'" Yahweh said to him, "What's that in your hand?" And he said, "A staff." And he said, "Throw it on the ground." And he threw it on the ground. and it became a servant and a serpent, and Moses ran from it. But Yahweh said to Moses, put out your hand and catch it by the tail. So he put his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. That they may believe that Yahweh, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Again, Yahweh said to him, put your hand inside your cloak. And he put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous, like snow. And God said, put your hand back inside your cloak. So he put his hand back inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. If they will not believe me, God said, or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. But if they will not believe even those two signs or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile, pour it on the dry ground, and the waters that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. Now you remember back in chapter 3 when Moses was appeared to by God. And his first response when God gave him his commission was to say, in effect, in verse 11, who am I that I should go to the Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? I don't have what it takes. I don't have the reputation. I don't have the ability. I don't have anything that is going to take from this job. Lord, I'm not competent for what you're asking me to do. And the Lord, of course, dealt with him in a significant way in the midst of that. And so having heard the Lord's response, the promise, I will be with you, in verse 13, he responds back. And Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel, and they say to them, and I say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? I don't have anything to say that would convince them. And I don't even know your name personally. I recognize you're the God of Abraham, Isaac, but I don't know enough. And we noticed last week this great central passage in the Bible on the name and character of God. And once again, God has given him a whole set of instructions, very carefully given. And so now we come to verse 1 of chapter 4. And God has told him all of these things that he is going to do, that he is promising to do. Actually, go back with me and just notice this in chapter 3. He's given some very specific directions. Verse 14, God said to Moses, I am who I am. Go to the, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And then he repeats himself in verse 15. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel. And then in verse 16, go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them. And God had given him a very clear assignment. Go to the people, my people, the people of Israel, go especially to the leaders. And notice verse 18. And they will listen to your voice. So God has promised in the midst of this that God will make it clear that he is to be believed and he is credible. It doesn't depend on Moses. God has given his promise. And against the back of that, we need to read verse 1. But behold, they won't believe me or listen to my voice. For they will say, Yahweh did not appear to me. Now, on one hand, we can understand Moses' problem. How do you convince people that God has really spoken to you? Hasn't happened for 400 years. And if you're somebody who's lived in the desert and you're totally anonymous, you haven't even been in Egypt for 40 years, you're a total stranger to these people. Somebody walks in out of the desert and comes into this church and says, God's got a message for you. How prone are you to believe that? Well, you shouldn't be prone at all if you show a modicum of wisdom. So, and the last time, what had happened the last time he tried to represent God? He did end up running for his life. So I've got no reputation, I've got no standing, I've got an amazing message, but who's going to believe it, that God appeared to me and he made the promise that you're going to get out of Egypt and you go to the promised land? But the real issue of Moses was that he wasn't willing to believe God. Moses' statement sounds like a reasonable objection, but it is blatant unbelief in the face of God's promise. And we're all prone to that. God has said it. Can I really trust him? Well, it's interesting. The Lord doesn't argue with him. He doesn't debate with him. Instead, what he does is give them a series of signs. It's interesting that signs in the Bible are the way in which God accredits a messenger. So even with the signs of the Lord Jesus, they're pointing to something beyond that. They're giving a direction. Listen, here's credibility. So God is giving him credibility in this way. The writer of Hebrews says, you need to pay attention to the message of the gospel, because God witnessed it by signs so that you may know that this is true. So God suddenly says to Moses, what's that in your hand? And it, of course, was a shepherd's staff. He has no idea. It's just his favorite stick. He's lived with that staff probably for years. He's wandered over the desert. He's been in all kinds of places doing different. He knows that staff as he knows almost like nothing else on earth. He knows every groove in it, every part of it. He knows it's only a stick. And God gives him a very clear command. Throw it on the ground. Now, it's interesting, there are times where Moses does choose to obey. And he throws it on the ground. And all of a sudden, you know the story, it becomes a snake. Not just any snake, but a snake from which he instinctively runs away. Clearly a poisonous snake of some kind. There's been all kinds of guesses about what it was, but it's important that a snake was important to the Egyptians. There was a cobra on the headdress of Pharaoh, and a cobra often related to different parts of Egyptian religion and Egyptian leadership. So maybe there was something in that as a reminder of that. And as Moses runs away, God turns and says to him, come back and pick it up by the tail. Now, he was a desert man. He'd lived in the wilderness. There are many things you do with a poisonous snake, but picking them up by the tail isn't one of those kind of things, because you leave the head to strike. But he obeys God. And instantly the snake becomes a stick. The serpent is changed back into what it was. And God gives this fascinating statement of discussion about it. So they may believe that Yahweh, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. This is a credibility that you're going to have. And that stick, before it will be extended over the Red Sea, and it will split the Red Sea. It will strike a rock, and water will gush forth. It will be lifted up, and plagues will occur. It's only a stick. But it's a stick that God is using. But apparently he had a look on his face that wasn't entirely satisfied. And so God says, stick your hand in your robe. And he sticks his hand in his robe. And he pulls it out. And it's leprous. And we don't know exactly what leprosy was in terms of modern medicine. There's what we call leprosy today is Hansen's disease, but biblical leprosy seems to be different from that, but we know three things about it. One is it was highly infectious. The second was that it was repulsive. And the third was that it was incurable. It's a symbol of death. It's a symbol of certain destruction. But then he says, put it back in. And he pulls it out, and it's clean. And then God says to him, maybe the Israelites, and remember these signs are given for the Israelites to believe who God is, says if they don't do that, when you get there, when you're at the Nile, go and take some water from the Nile and spill it on the ground, and it will become blood. Hard to overestimate the importance of the Nile to Egypt. It was the lifeline. Somebody's described Egypt as a populated strip that is 5 miles wide with sand on both sides of it, because everything depended on the life-giving power of the Nile. But the Nile becomes now a source of, a symbol of death. It turns into blood. Now, we're not told he ever did that. This is just a promise that's ahead of time in terms of the Israelites. Clearly, it's going to become important in the story in another way. Now, what is God saying to Moses in the midst of this? He's saying to Moses, if I send you, I will equip you. If you're called by me and you're given my promise, I will enable you to do what I've commanded you to do. I'm not sending you out there in your strength. I'm not sending you out there on the basis of your ability that you have these awesome talents. I will enable you to do what I command you to do. And there's something about that even in the words of the Lord Jesus when he commands them to be witnesses in Judea and Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the earth. And he says, I'm with you when the Spirit comes upon you. Or at the end of the book of Matthew when he says, go and make disciples of all nations. And he says, I will be with you. So the promise is that when God commissions us, he promises us to enable us. Second thing that's here is that a stick and a hand and water are among the most ordinary things that you can imagine. But what Moses needs to know is that God can do extraordinary things through ordinary instruments. And as we think about that in larger biblical truth, that's something that became central to the life of the Apostle Paul. He goes on and says about his own life, we have this treasure in clay pots. So the surpassing greatness might be of God. The greatness of the power may be of God and not of ourselves. Or God gives him, as we remember in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, the thorn in the flesh, and then tells him, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. Moses, I don't need a strong man, I need a faithful man. And God is going to use him for his glory, in his way, in God's purposes. Imagine for a minute, I was thinking about this week, imagine what Moses would have missed out on if he hadn't done what God had called him to do. Some of the most amazing experiences that any person on planet Earth has ever had. As a matter of fact, apart from being with the Lord Jesus, being alongside Moses and see the things that happened and God used him for, and he's complaining about his inadequacy, but God is promising his presence. But Moses still isn't learning the lesson. There's always a reason that we can find that sounds good. And so he comes back in verses 10 to 12. But Moses said to Yahweh, oh my Lord, I'm not eloquent, either in the past or since you've spoken to your servant, for I am, and the word is heavy, I'm heavy of speech and of tongue. Then Yahweh said to him, who's made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, Yahweh? Now therefore go. I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak. Now I think we look at verse 10 and we hear Moses making this complaint. Clearly, he's understood. If I've got to go to Pharaoh and speak to Pharaoh, I need to be eloquent. I need to be able to present a case. I mean, I'm asking for something incredible. I better be right at the top of my game, sharp, on the point, gifted, able to make all the arguments that need to be taken. And if I'm to lead Israel, lead, there's hundreds of thousands of people. I'm slow to speak. I'm heavy of speech. I've never been articulate. Now, we don't know what Moses meant. It's possible that he had a speech impediment, and some people think that he genuinely had a speech impediment of some kind, or that he stuttered. It may have been that he's saying, I haven't spoken Egyptian or Hebrew for 40 years, and talking to sheep all day hasn't really equipped me to go and stand in front of Pharaoh and do the things you're asking, or in front of a people and rally them. Or maybe he's like a lot of people and says, I don't do public speaking. I'm willing to do anything, but actually there's polls that say that's the number one fear of all kinds of people, to speak in public. And I just don't have the gift of the gab. I don't have the ability to say things and do the right things and to think on my feet and say those things. I don't know what it was for Moses. It's interesting, the Lord doesn't argue with him. He doesn't come back and say, oh no, you're, well, come back to that in just a minute. We do know, interestingly, two things. Stephen in Acts chapter 7 describes him as mighty in word and in deed. And the second thing is that, and it may well be that he just learns in the process, because as we read through the story, we'll see Aaron talking, Moses talking, and by the time we get to the end of the book of Deuteronomy, for example, it ends with some of the most eloquent parts of Scripture, that he had those gifts and those abilities, and he was really saying, I don't want to use them. But here's the central issue. Moses didn't have a speech problem, he had an obedience problem. And many times we have these other things to tell the Lord why we can't do these things, and it isn't the problem that we're claiming. It is at root an obedience problem. And it's interesting that God doesn't come back at Moses with a kind of prosperity theology or possible, oh, Moses, you've really got the gifts, and if you try hard, you need to believe it. You need to name it and claim it. You need to trust that you can do this. I'll help you. It's all there. No, he says two things. Your complaint is irreverent. You're forgetting who you're talking to. I'm not someone who's limited by your particular ability. I am the Lord of speech and people's capacities. Who made man's mouth? Who made him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, says Yahweh? I am sovereign Lord over all things. Now it raises all kinds of interesting questions and things related to that about how God works his sovereignty. But it is a promise for a believer that when we find ourselves with these particular challenges, those are not outside the will, purpose, plan, and usefulness of God. We were watching together, Elizabeth and I, this past week, the life story of a remarkable woman named Frances, Fanny Crosby. And Fanny Crosby was blinded by a stupid doctor when she was just a child who put things and ruined her life. And over the course of years, she wrote 9,000 hymns. Many of them we still sing and admire. And she was able to trust in the fact that God was sovereign even over that doctor who turned out to be a fake and who left town afterwards because of what had happened. But God is sovereign in all of those things. But it says it's not only irreverent, it's irrelevant. Notice verse 12. Now therefore go. I will be with your mouth. I'll teach you what to say. I am able where you are not able. Moses sounded like he was being humble. He was being rebellious. When God had promised they would listen to him, he comes back with excuses. And he needed to learn that Moses' inadequacy was not a problem for God, that he was more than able to do it and able to meet the needs in that particular way. If God calls us, our call is to obey and trust his promise. But he's not through yet. Verse 13. But he said, Oh my Lord, please send someone else. Then the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Moses, and he said, is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know he can speak well. Behold, he's coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You will speak to him and put the words in his mouth. I will be with your mouth and with his mouth and will teach you both what to do. He shall speak for you to the people. He will be your mouth and you shall be as God to him. And take in your hand this staff with which you shall do the signs. Lord, I'm not available. Please get someone else. Anyone else. I don't want to. He's polite, please. And he's rebellious. Lord, get someone else. That reminds me of Peter. Remember Peter standing in front of the Lord saying, no, Lord. If there's two words that don't go together, it's no, Lord. If he's calling you to do something, you cannot say Lord and no in the same voice. But that's what Moses is doing at this particular point. He is saying he's not available to God's purposes and plans. And the Lord, it says, got angry. It's interesting that he's put up with all of this. He listens to the complaint about inadequacy. He complains about ignorance, incompetence. But when he says he's not available, the Lord is angry. It's a gracious anger. It's the kind of anger a parent has toward a child who will not do what that parent knows is absolutely the right thing for him to do and is crucial to all kinds of things in the future. I'm not going to do it. And the parent rightly gets mad, not because of how it's affecting the parent, because of the damage that that child is doing to the things they're doing. It is the parental anger of love that fails to understand what he's turning his back on, and God will have nothing to do with it. And it's interesting, he gives two things to Moses as a provision. If I can put it this way, one is a sibling and the other one is a stick. The sibling. It's interesting what he says at this particular point, and it raises all kinds of questions in my mind, and I suspect in yours. Isn't Aaron your brother, the Levite? Aaron was 3 years older than him. We'll read in chapter 7 and verse 7. This is the first time he's mentioned in the book. He's been out of Egypt for 40 years, Moses has. And you wonder, how well did Aaron even know him? I mean, he'd left the family when he was 5 years of age. He'd been raised in the palace of Pharaoh. How much back and forth had they had over the years? Aaron's his older brother, but how much did he know him? And did Aaron even know where he was? Did Aaron have any sense of who he was? Had there been any back and forth? All of those are questions we don't answer. But God comes to him and says, if you're saying you can't speak, I'll solve the problem for you. I know he can speak well. He'll be the solution. And he goes on to explain that a little bit further. Verse 17, you shall speak to him, and I will, and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you both what to do. So I'll speak to you, you'll speak to Aaron, he'll speak to Pharaoh and the people. He shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be as God to him. In other words, Aaron is the spokesman of the message that comes from God, and he represents God to Aaron. Now, there's something in the midst of all of this, and by the way, Moses probably, when this all came together, thought this was a good thing. But he's going to find out that Aaron is gifted and able, but Aaron is also going to be the source of one of the biggest problems the nation ever has when he's involved in the golden calf episode. So, this is not an unmixed blessing of having Aaron there. But notice something else. The thing that I find fascinating is that God knew exactly the way this conversation was going to go. Did you notice that where I stopped reading? In verse 14, is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he's coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. Look down at verse 27. We'll come here next week. Yahweh said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. Before Moses ever made his objection, God had already dealt with Aaron. Aaron was already on the way to meet him. I have no idea how God appeared to Aaron, how God had all of this together. Somehow it was compelling enough that Aaron has left everything to come to Mount Sinai, where he is, although Moses is going to leave there and come back there before he can meet him. And God has already providentially foreseen all that's going to happen, and it's already in the way. Before ever even Moses had any idea that the need existed, God had worked ahead of time on it. Elizabeth loves to tell the story, as I do too. When we were first married and we had what little money that we had, having summer job and we'd gotten married, and Elizabeth had been a major responsible for that, and we'd bought a car, and we were coming with, I think, $750 total of our money and resources at that time, and we were moving down to Canada, down to Dallas, and Elizabeth had received a green card. I was on a student visa, so she could teach, but the only job was going to be student teaching in the public schools, which was very uncertain. And so how were we going to get through all of this? So we got to Dallas, and of course this was a kind of everything new for Elizabeth. I'd been there for a year, and it was also, but I went to the mailbox, and I pulled out a mail and brought it home and gave it to Elizabeth, and she opened it, and it was an invitation from the Christian school to begin teaching 2 days later. And before ever we had any idea of what was going on, God had prepared the way. Have you ever had a need, and then you get a check in the mail, and you begin to think, that check was written for this need, it's got here exactly the right day, but God had already worked in some Aaron's heart over there to put the check in the mail a week before you even knew the need was going to have come. And there was God's provision. And God had provided a way in a significant way. So Aaron is going to come into the story, and God is going to use him, but he is going to be, at this point, the spokesman. But we'll see as we walk through the story, that's going to change as Moses learns that he can trust God to put the words he needs in his mouth. And then we have in verse 17, take in your hand this sign, the staff with which you will do the signs. Oh, and I have to have you look ahead to verse 30. Again, we'll come to this next week. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses, did the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed. And when he heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel, he'd seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshiped. They won't believe me. And God's answer, leave it to me. And they did. But I picture the story, and this caught my fancy. Here's Moses in a few weeks walking away back to get his family to come back to Egypt. And all he has in his hand as a symbol of what God is going to do is a stick, just an ordinary staff. And soon he'll be joined by a sibling. What odds are you going to give that a man with a stick and a sibling are going to go and overpower the greatest nation on earth? A stick and a sibling. And God uses them as he purposed to for his glory. The reality is, and just to notice a couple of things, God knows us better than we know ourselves. And if God genuinely calls us, we can trust in his enabling power and grace. A second thing this story tells me is that God's great purpose is not to enhance the messenger, but to show his glory. The very fact that all he had was a stick and a sibling was going to make it very clear to Pharaoh that there is a God, that Yahweh is God. This cannot be explained on the basis of anything else. I love the story of the man who came to D.L. Moody when he was in England the first time, and D.L. Moody murdered the king's English, the queen's English at that point in the 19th century. He had very unusual speech patterns. He hadn't got much education, but God used him in a powerful way. And a man came up to him after one of the messages that had filled London, which was, and the churches of London, and they had responded. And the man came up to him and said to him, "Moody, this must be of God, because I can see no connection between who you are and what God is doing." And over and over and over, we see God taking our weakness and using it in ways that we can't imagine. One of the fun times in our life came when we had moved to Dallas and something had happened. It was fairly early when we were there. Elizabeth had given her testimony at a particular meeting, and then a few days later someone phoned and I heard the conversation going on at the other end. And she's saying, "No, I don't do that. I've got a newborn baby and I sleep when I can." And she had several other things that was going on, and she said, I don't do women. And she got off the phone. I said, "Who was that?" And she said, "It happened to be a friend who'd moved to Winnipeg, who I knew from my home church." And she said, "She asked me to lead a Bible study with a group of insurance executives. And I've never done that before. I don't know how to lead a Bible study to a group of things. And I don't do women, and I don't have time." And I can remember saying to her, "Get on the phone, tell her you'll do it, and I'll help you do all that you can." Now, can you imagine if Elizabeth had not used the gifts and abilities that she's used so much broadly, if there hadn't been an irritating person there to challenge her to go to the next step? Because God knew her in giving that possibility in a way that she didn't know herself. She had no idea of the gifts that were latent within her, but they were all there. I didn't help her very much. I just encouraged her at different times along the way. God knows us better than we know ourselves. The great mission of life is not to fulfill ourselves, but to glorify God. And thirdly, God's call is to follow him in a life of obedience. I've told you the story before, or you've heard me tell the story before, of Elizabeth's relative who was a major leader in the British Merchant Marine. And in 1953, an invitation came to their house addressed to Captain Alwyn Davies and his wife, Elizabeth's uncle by marriage, with an impressive envelope from Buckingham Palace. And they were opened it and they were amazed to read, "We greet you well." This is literally what it said. "Whereas we've appointed the second day of June 1953 for the solemnity of our coronation, these are thereby to will and command all excuses set aside, that you make your attendance upon us at the time above mentioned, there to do and to perform such services as will be required of you. And I've always loved that phrase. These are to will and command, all excuses set aside. If that's true for a constitutional monarch, how much more true of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords as we respond to him and his will and his purpose for us.